about that story? If the Peter Nygaard or Frank Stronach or Gian Gomeshi scandals had happened elsewhere, they'd have made movies about those stories. If the Portapique massacre had happened elsewhere, they sadly would probably have made a movie about it. Wet'suwet'en, that could be a great movie. The Michael Bryant affair, imagine a Sorkin screenplay. I would watch that movie. And what about the Rogers family drama? Imperious and secretive billionaire telecom overlord clan, loathed across the nation, a doughy heir to the throne and his campy fashionista wife hanging out at Mar-a-Lago, his secret scheme to seize control of his dead daddy's empire, exposed by an errant butt dial. Side plots about Masai Ujiri and Mayor John Tory. Yeah, if that had happened anywhere else, you bet they'd make a movie about it. But it happened in Canada. So they made a one-man play about it. As it happens, it's written by my friend, the brilliant playwright, Michael Healy. And he joins me in a minute. Wait for it. All right. Tell me, if you will, tell me your name and what you do.
My name is Michael Healy, and I'm a playwright. I work in the theater. I don't know why I felt the need to append "I work in the theater" to "I'm a playwright."
Well, one thing that is wonderful about being a playwright is that you could write about anything. You could write drama about universal topics that anybody could find a point of connection with.
Correct. Theoretically.
What have you chosen to write plays about?
You know what? Go yourself. I understand that my the sandbox that I work in is dull, is aggressively dull. In the main, I write about public service. And so that takes me into the realm of doing for others. It's not a huge leap from there to politics and the idea of politics. And I've really found that politics is a very fruitful kind of area for me because there are two competing imperatives for somebody who wants to be in politics. And one is public service. And the other one is, I need to get reelected. And those two things are in tension all the time in various different ways. And so that provides a lot of comedy. It provides the potential for drama. It provides farce and, in some cases, actual tragedy.
You're very defensive.
Yes.
Which will be necessary once you're attacked. But I'm actually just trying to give the listener a sense, as I speak to a miniaturist, of just how microscopic the area that you've chosen. You write for the theater, which people don't really go to.
Right.
You write about public service, a topic that very few people care about.
Yes.
You write about public service with specific reference.
Yes.
To Canada.
Yes.
You've written how many plays about our prime ministers and our
Well, I mean, it depends on how you're scoring it. Like five or six explicitly about federal politics. And then a couple more about public servants, you know, non-elected people who are attempting to do a hard thing on behalf of all of us and who are thwarted in various entertaining ways until it finally crushes them, you know. So it really depends on how you're scoring it. But yeah, for the most part, it's like six or seven plays explicitly about politics.
You wrote a play about a public service urban development project in Toronto that did not proceed.
Yes, that's exactly right. And you'll be surprised to learn I had the entire field to myself. I did not have to race to get my play about Sidewalk Labs out before any of the other plays.
You weren't scooped. This wasn't like the
two competing
Capote films or Armageddon versus Deep Impact.
Exactly.
You had the whole thing to yourself.
And I could just take my time. It was great.
I am in a unique position to really maximize the hypocrisy here, because the wonderful thing about podcasting is you could speak to the world from anywhere.
Right.
And you can make a hit podcast for the whole damn world.
Yes.
I chose to call it Canada Land.
Right, exactly.
So we kind of like have the same I don't know, albatross or magic flute?
You, if anybody, should understand what I'm up against and what I've, how I've, you know, chosen to...
The corners that we've painted ourselves into.
Exactly.
And that I've spent a certain amount of time trying to tell the story of the Rogers clan.
Uh-huh.
There have been three or four episodes in the Canada Land Archives. I've done deep dives into the Rogers family lore and archives.
Yes.
And we found a novelty song about Ted Rogers.
Come and listen to a story of a man named Ted, just a humble lawyer trying to earn a little bread, until he had an epiphany to put a Rogers cable on the back of your TV. Goodbye, rabbit ears. Hello, Mr. Rogers.
Hello, neighbor.
Now before too long, Ted becomes a millionaire. He and wife Loretta living life without a care. And then one day his young son Ed climbed up onto his knee and said, "What's next, Ted?" "Cellular phones, video stores, internet, Blue Jays, Rogers Center." And now you see the Rogers name in almost every home. They even got a thing they call the Rogers telephone.
Oh, God.
Ted actually, you know, was he an innovator or was he just sort of a gambler who
right.
was willing to leverage it all
right.
because he saw the wave of cable coming.
Right. And then he saw cell phones coming.
He saw cell phones coming.
He said, "I want to like sell off some of the cable and get into cell phones."
Yeah.
And his own board said no, including his wife, who was on the board at the time. And so he took his own money and bought and built a cell phone company, which eventually everybody at Rogers went, "Oh, actually, good idea, bro." And then they became a division of Rogers.
So you've drunk the Ted Rogers Kool-Aid that he was
a
prescient.
God.
He's a visionary.
I'm being facetious.
From a Canadian viewpoint,
yes.
If you work in telecom, who didn't see these things coming? You could just watch a few miles to the south to see what
was coming.
So
easy to say now. But here's be the Rogers board for a second.
Yeah.
And you're making metric tons of money just in cable across the country. And it's subscription-based, and all of the infrastructure's already there. And
did you have a Rogers cable box with the push buttons?
Oh, of course.
It was like fake wood paneling, like the station wagon that I drove.
With a thing that goes all the way to the back of the TV cord, and you go clonk, clonk. Yeah.
Which itself was a technology that many people thought was not going anywhere.
Yes, of course.
But Ted knew it was, because it was already doing that in the States, and we just do what they do 5 years later. But
exactly.
No, he's a genius. Go on.
No, he's not a genius. I'm mostly kidding about, is he an innovator or is he just like a kind of an opportunist? But I think an argument could be made that Rogers could have stopped, Rogers Communications could have stopped as a cable company and then kind of fallen apart the way that the Seagram family fell apart.
Yeah.
Right?
That is true, that the traditional trajectory for a wealthy Canadian family is if you're making bucket loads of money off of something and it's in danger of being made obsolete, they cling desperately to the thing that works, and they don't want to risk anything.
Right.
And when he saw these waves coming, he gambled and faced resistance to gamble, and those gambles paid off repeatedly.
Yeah, at least twice.
Mm-hmm.
At least two times.
At least twice.
Cable and then cell phones.
And there were a couple that we don't talk about that didn't work out quite as
well.
Oh,
my God. Sure.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
We did an episode called The Rogers Family Compact that I just re-listened to. And if I do say so myself, when it comes to dramatizing the story of the Rogers,
yes,
you got some competition.
Okay.
Because I was there with Cherise Sucherin and Jonathan Goldsby at the time. It was a pretty fun episode. There was a conversation, just to talk about my own Rogers work.
Please.
Where we're trying to parse... To what degree can you consider somebody a self-made, like Horatio Alger, rags-to-riches case when he went to UCC?
In the heart of Toronto, Canada, at a boarding school called Upper Canada College, a young man was fulfilling his destiny. Ted Rogers was born in the spirit of invention.
And it is interesting because Ted Rogers, relatively, his father invented... the battery-free radio.
Right.
In 1924, Ted's father, Edward S. Rogers, invented an alternating current tube for radios. That meant radios could be powered by electricity instead of heavy, leaky batteries.
Invented with air quotes. My understanding is the father actually bought a patent from a guy and then executed it, and so now is credited with the batteryless radio.
That's I think that somebody would have figured it out.
We all would have gotten there eventually.
To plug it into the wall without any batteries.
Right.
Somebody would have gotten there, but it was Ted Rogers' father. And then the family story goes that he died young and I think he said some rogue fleeced the widow.
And so most of what he had was closed down or sold, or I say stolen, by some rogue.
Okay, stick around. After the break, we will continue the superhero, or perhaps supervillain, origin story of Ted Rogers. So where we left off, Ted Rogers is lamenting that a radio station his family owned was fleeced from his mother by some, quote, rogue.
For me, as a dramatist, I'm looking for the emotional connection in a story. And the lore is that the uncle talked the mother into selling CFRB, the radio station, and then Ted Rogers worked most of his adult life trying to buy it back because his mother had made this terrible mistake.
And apparently his mother brought him up with the marching orders for his life. You must restore the family name in the world of Canadian telecoms.
My mother was always very strong that I had an obligation to try and get it back and to do my best to get the family name restored in communications to what it was.
Which is a weird, as far as like sort of Shakespearean,
right.
You know.
In terms of mothers horning in on what you're going to do with your life.
Yeah. You know, weirdly, my mom had the same advice for me, and we had nothing to do with the telecom business. But she was quite mad.
Yeah. Well, mothers, we don't need to go down. I mean, the play gets into parents a little bit.
Yeah.
Gets into that kind of legacy. You know, the play is about Ted's son, Edward, who eventually takes control of Rogers Communications away from his mother and his sisters in a very kind of bald act of corporate and quite public betrayal. And now he now runs the place by himself.
This was a really rare moment in Canadian public life because when we talk about this class of family, you know, your McCains and your Westons, Canadian oligarchs keep a much lower profile. The Rogers were always a little bit different, mostly because of Suzanne, because Ed's wife is like fashiony and extra and
right.
fun. But you didn't hear about Rogers fighting. You didn't hear about anybody fighting.
No, you know, of course not.
I mean, I guess the Stronics are a big scandalous exception to that. But the Rogers suddenly are bashing at each other in the headlines. We were all over it because it's just not something that happens a lot in Canada.
That's right. And one of the sisters is tweeting, and there's, you know, public documents, court documents, so we've got access to everybody's perspective and what the fight is. And so, yes, it's a very rare thing to see. And I think that's why Alexandra's book, Alexandra Pozadsky, wrote the book Rogers v. Rogers, on which my play is based. She's a Globe and Mail reporter who followed the story while it was happening and then wrote a very carefully reported book about all of this stuff.
And you better be careful in this litigious country.
Yeah, that's right. But she was, and nobody sued her. And anyway, it's a great document in terms of a minute by minute from the initial blow up through the court case in BC of this family kind of getting fully exposed and then trying to tuck it all back in, you know?
My recollection of this was that, like a lot of things Canadian, even when they seem super exciting, they resolve to the least interesting conclusion.
Right.
So tell me if I've got the basic structure of this correct. You had, following the passing of Ted Rogers, sibling rivalry between his somewhat ne'er-do-well son, Ed Rogers, who was kind of like a fun party boy in university and then wanted to be the CEO, and Ted Rogers sort of dangled it and was like, well, he might not be the right guy for it. And then Melinda, who seemed like a bit more of the on-the-ball hotshot with the corporate chops.
Yeah.
And this game of succession where which of the kids is going to get it, he was always sending mixed signals. And at the time of his passing, he said, look, it ain't going to be my decision, but it's not going to be one of my kids because it's up to the board who's going to be the next CEO, and neither of them are ready.
You're right about this. The succession planning for you is really on two tracks, isn't it?
On two tracks. And Edward has been chosen by me and by Will.
This is your son, Edward.
To be the second one. Now, he and Melinda would like desperately to also be the CEO, but that will be up to a board committee and then the board. And we have, as you pointed out, a fair number of very talented and experienced people. And so right now it would be, despite my being so proud of everything Edward's done, he's been there for 17 years. He's done every crappy job there is. He's not been spoiled. He's met his targets. So he says, well, why not me? And he's right, except that there are others that have more experience, and the board will have to make that decision. It's too hard for a father.
The thing about him is, at least in the narrative in the book and in the narrative that I'm pursuing, is that he was an unimpressive individual.
Uh-huh.
And his father said on many different occasions that Edward's not ready, Edward needs more time, he's like a fine wine, blah, blah, blah. And so he just found like many ways to insult his son Edward in public about this, about his competence.
Yeah.
And so Edward waited, bided his time, and eventually found himself in this position where he could do this. But really, a lot of that has to do with a kind of weird passivity on the part of the board and the members of his family, kind of counting on Edward, to not take all of this power that is right there at his feet.
The sort of norms of the company were to let the actual mechanisms do their business, let the board decide, let the market decide.
Ted had created all of these corporate governance structures that had to do with the choosing of a CEO.
Yeah.
The striking of a committee, this is what we're going to do. There was a lot of structure in place. The things that Ted Rogers would never have put up with, by the way, in terms of corporate governance. But he had all these things in place.
In that they were so formal and,
they were so formal.
And organized and,
yes.
and not dynamic and by the seat of your pants and gutsy.
That's
and,
right.
and impetuous.
He wanted family control to remain, but he also wanted the kind of professionalization of the corporation to happen, and that means bringing in outside people. He wanted both of these things, and they're in competition with each other, but no lawyer is going to sit there and tell Ted Rogers that he's being irrational.
Right.
You know, about his dreams for how his family maintains control of the company, but how the company gets fully professionalized at the same time.
Right. Those things are kind of at odds with each other.
Yeah.
So Ted Rogers stayed on as CEO until his death in 2008. After Ted's death, Rogers goes through a few CEOs in relatively rapid succession, but all of them have to deal with Ted's wacky planning. In that, to my understanding, they had to take the job even though Ted's ne'er-do-well son, Edward, could try and outmaneuver them at any time, right? In fact, there was like an escape clause built into the contracts of these CEOs. I think it was referred to as the Edward Rogers clause, right? Where it were like the CEO would get paid out their entire contract even if they were forced out years before the contract was up. And who was the first CEO to succeed Ted? Was that Nadir Mohammed?
Nadir Mohammed, you know, became CEO right after Ted.
He was there for almost 5 years.
$18 million was his payout. So, yeah, like he was in this ridiculous position where Edward Rogers was his subordinate as a vice president, but also he was on the board and on the control trust. So Nadir Mohammed was in this impossible circumstance where Edward was both his subordinate and his superior, and he lasted 3 years. If you believe a narrative where Edward Rogers makes it uncomfortable as possible for Nadir Mohammed in an effort to force him out so that he can try again to become CEO, then the corporate structure is still well enough in place that Guy Lawrence shows up, is impressive in an interview, but then starts making all these incredibly stupid decisions. So Edward Rogers now just has to bide his time because Guy Lawrence is, like, from the minute he shows up, his days are numbered because
uh-huh.
he just makes stupid decision after stupid decision. So in some ways, the narrative that I'm building in the play is that Edward Rogers just has to be patient.
And when he decides to make his move, he needs to deceive his own mother. All right, Michael, here we are recounting the trials and travails of the Rogers family saga. We are up to the point in the story where Ed Rogers, scheming to set himself up as CEO, needs to deceive his mom.
Yes, he needs to break his mother's heart and kind of push his sisters out and install his own CEO. And so then, as board chair, he can retitle himself as executive board chair. So he's effectively the CEO, and he's got a CEO underneath him who is willing to share the power that a CEO traditionally holds.
Those are the table stakes under Edward now.
That's right.
You're really working for Edward.
There's a guy named Joe Natale who gets brought in after Guy Lawrence. And so Edward now has to find a way to push out Joe Natale, who's seems like an extremely competent guy. And the reason I found the book interesting is he has to push that guy out so he can take over finally. At the moment when Rogers is also attempting the...
They want to gobble up Shaw.
That's right. So number two in the telecom space is going to buy number four in the telecom space. And there's all sorts of reasons why that's a bad idea. And there's all sorts of regulators who are charged with stopping that or making sure that doesn't happen outright.
What role in your dramatized version of these events does the butt dial play?
It's peripheral. Like... In terms of every interesting...
See, I would have gone right for the butt dial, but
right.
You're a classier...
No, I'm not. Like, to continue the theme of this, I choose the least interesting path whenever it's available to me.
Right.
The corporate psychodrama of the Rogers family and Edward's pursuit of this job is less than half of what my play actually contains.
You're really interested in the regulatory side of things.
Here's what I'm interested in.
Where's the CRTC in this
exactly.
grand drama?
Well,
let's get to the good stuff.
So there is, on page 300 of Alexandra's book, This guy is introduced. His name is Matthew Boswell. He is the Competition Commissioner of Canada. And when he learns that Rogers is going to merge with Shaw, he decides that he is going to put a stop to this, that this is unconscionable. And this should never happen.
Mm-hmm.
This is ridiculous. The government has spent too long trying to create a fourth national player in the telecom space for us to just give up and let Rogers buy Shaw.
Yeah. This has been the Competition Bureau and the CRTC and a success of governments. If we could just get a fourth company.
Right.
Three companies the consumer gets screwed in Canada. We
right.
need a fourth company.
The magic fourth company.
And they have been waving magic wands to create fourth companies again and again, and they just invariably get gobbled up by one of those three companies.
That's right. Yes, exactly. But this guy won't have it, and he's going to go outside his own comfort zone, outside the limits of what a bureaucrat is usually allowed to do.
Is this the hero of the play? Is the antitrust guy?
He's the hero of this play. I'm telling you, all of this stuff about the butt dial and the screwing his mother, that's terrible. Like, all of that stuff, I was not interested in Alexandra's book until this guy...
Until you got to the antitrust
until
stuff.
I get to the... Until
Hello.
Until I get to a public servant who is out over his skis trying to do a hard thing on our behalf.
Hello, suddenly, Hollywood.
Suddenly I'm interested.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
Now this is a marketable project.
Exactly.
Dear God, if you are confused by the discussion of a butt dial, the reason why Joe Natale became aware that Edward Rogers was scheming to oust him is because Joe Natale, at the time the CEO of Rogers, phone rings. He picks up his phone, says hello, and just hears weird muffled sounds, which we all know what that means. When nobody says hello back to you, you have been dialed accidentally. We call this a butt dial. And he recognizes the voices he hears. And it is Tony Staffieri.
Yes. And a guy, it's the other way. So Joe decides to call Tony on some matter. And Tony Staffieri takes out his phone and... The guy he's about to replace is calling him, so he's anxious. So instead of hanging up the phone, he answers the phone, and then he puts it in his pocket. Like, it's even dumber than you think. So
it's worse than a butt dial.
Right.
I just got fact-checked by a playwright. All right, continue.
So now Joe Natale is effectively in Tony Staffieri's jacket pocket.
Literally.
It's the pandemic. So he and this guy are sitting outside on a bench, and he's, like, talking to this lawyer, saying, Joe Natale is about to get fucked. I'm going to take over as CEO. This is all hilarious. And would you like to come and be on my team? And that's what Joe Natale overhears.
And this is how it gets out, if I recall.
That's right.
And then that's when you've got things like Martha Rogers, who we haven't mentioned yet.
That's right.
Who is a Rogers daughter who according to her Twitter profile at the time, was a naturopathic doctor.
Yes.
But then when Canada Land realized that she hadn't been practicing, we checked to see if she had a license. And the College of Naturopaths said, you can't call yourself a naturopathic doctor if you don't have a license.
Uh-huh.
Leading to a lot of really unfortunate jokes about, like, what do you call a fake naturopathic doctor?
Oh, my God.
I actually felt bad for Martha Rogers, because Martha Rogers was cool during all of this and was...
Well, she was tweeting.
She was tweeting.
So her brother didn't get to choose the moment because of the butt dial. He didn't get to choose the moment when he was going to execute the removal of Joe and the installation
of Tony. The only reason why any of this came out in the public, the only reason why Family Drama got aired was because of this phone call. Your play wouldn't exist, our podcast. This probably would have all played out.
Yes.
There'd be some references to it in the business section that we wouldn't know what it all means.
Probably, yeah.
And instead of that, we found that Melinda Rogers was vocal about this, Martha Rogers was vocal. We even got statement from Loretta Rogers that Edward had lied to her, given false information about Joe Natale's performance in order to get her support to oust him. This is when it all became dirty laundry in public.
Yes, and through it all, Martha is very helpfully tweeting about her brother and about all of the shenanigans that he's attempting to execute.
A comic turn of circumstance that drives the narrative, not interesting to you.
It's of minimal interest to me, Jesse.
Yeah.
That's too easy. That's too boring. It's also... What do I fucking care about the Rogers family and how they spend their time or what they do?
Like, no, there's one good man, a public servant who says enough to this oligopoly rule in Canada. I'm taking a stand. And because he was victorious, he is the one we should celebrate on our stage.
He's not victorious.
No, he's not
victorious.
He loses. He loses.
Shaw gets gobbled up by Rogers. The only thing that the industry minister does is he says that you have to hive off Freedom Mobile. Shaw owns Freedom Mobile, which used to be Wind Mobile. You have to hive that off and sell it, but then you can go ahead and gobble up. And he does this, the industry minister does this, while my guy, Matthew Boswell, is attempting to build an argument, make an argument in front of a tribunal who's empowered with, who could stop this merger.
But they're all former Rogers employees on the tribunal.
Well, no, they're not. But they are in the bag. Part of what's interesting here is how in the tank for our corporate overlords our regulators are.
Yeah.
Our politicians are, and the CRTC, who lets the thing sail through while acknowledging that things will absolutely get worse for the consumer, but sure, go ahead and buy Shaw. So my guy is attempting to do this very hard thing. He's got nothing but headwinds. He's understaffed. He's underfunded. And he's trying desperately to make this thing stop. The thing that was interesting to me in the book, in all seriousness, is if I'm Edward Rogers, why am I attempting this corporate coup at the same time as I'm attempting this merger?
I wondered that as well, because midstream, while things seem to be going fairly like his way with Joe Natale, you're going to change CEOs?
Right. And you're going to get rid of Joe Natale, who has CEO experience, who's the guy, because he's such a pro, he can make the arguments to the regulators that other people can't. And he's just a competent, experienced guy. And so why would you get rid of that guy, install Rogers' CFO, who has no experience as CEO, in this job at this moment? The irrationality of that, from Edward's perspective, also was a kind of prime motivator for me as a dramatist.
And did you have a theory?
Because it seems emotional as opposed to rational.
Uh-huh.
And so you've got a father who never respected you. You've got a family who doesn't respect you. You have all of this power available to you that your family assumes you will never use. And so you're going to execute this thing. But now you've got Joe Natale. And I think maybe it's possible that Edward Rogers thought, if Joe Natale actually gets the Shaw merger done, he's going to be a hero and it'll be impossible.
This is the last stand of me having real power here.
Any kind of leverage to
even if Joe Natale can do it, I'm going to betray my mother's trust, go against my sisters, put in my stooge, and accomplish the same thing, which I'm less equipped to do, but I'll prove that I can do it.
Yes.
And that's how I'll cement my position and show that Dad was wrong.
The way I break it down is I don't think he cared about the Shaw acquisition. He cared more about acquiring all of the power in the corporation. If the Shaw merger had to fall apart as a result of that, so be it. Uh-huh. That's my speculation.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. One thing they're wondering is, if we're going to allow Rogers to become that much more powerful, is it a stable, sane company?
Right. Exactly. And during all of this, the Shaw network goes down not once, but twice.
Yeah, remember that outage?
Yes, substantially. And so literally one-third of the 911 access of Interac in the country. Suddenly, none of that works. Maps don't work. And so,
critical infrastructure basically fails.
If ever there was an illustration of why we need diversity among the telecom industry,
fail-safes and redundancy.
Right.
Yeah.
And all of this happens. The Rogers family looks like a bit of a clown car. You know, these things are falling apart. Edward's wife is tweeting pictures from Mar-a-Lago,
yeah,
where they're all in line with Trump at a moment when Trump is not particularly popular in this country. So a lot going on that would seem to suggest that maybe the Rogers family doesn't have a shit together, and the Rogers Corporation, it would be bad for the country if further consolidation is allowed in this sector, and still it's allowed to go ahead.
Still it's allowed to go ahead. And your hero.
Yes. Matthew Boswell.
Boswell. Fails.
Yes.
So really, this is a tragedy. You've written a tragedy.
Well, he doesn't kill himself. Technically, to be a tragedy, you have to kill yourself or you have to die at the end of a thing. So it's kind of a comedy with a sad ending. But, and I don't want to spoil the play for anybody, but things change for the better for Matthew Boswell, mostly as a result of this. But also just because he's such a loud pain in the ass.
Well, with a teaser like that, I don't know how you're going to...
That's right.
Most countries, most cultures dramatize what happens within their cultures.
Yeah.
We tell stories about the rich and the powerful. We tell stories about the follies of the people whose lives and decisions...
If this were an American
story... We don't do
story,
that! You're the only guy doing that!
Adam McKay would have snapped up the rights to Alexandra's book and made... What's the movie about the financial crisis in 2008? The Big Short.
The Big Short.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of five movies about that.
Right. If this was an American story, he would have snapped up the rights to this book, and he would have made it... And the Rogers family would have been huge in the movie, and Matthew Boswell would have been big in the movie, too.
We have documentary versions of the Murdoch family. We have dramatized versions of the Murdoch family. People know who the Murdochs are through, like, jokes about, like, they are processed through American culture.
Yes.
We don't do that in Canada.
No.
But for the work of Michael Healy.
That's right. So I should be protected at all costs. Let's be clear that I'm going to ride my bike home from this, and let's make sure I don't get run over.
By Heritage Canada.
Yes.
This should be protected.
I should be fenced in.
Thanks again, Michael.
Thank you.
Oh, that was fun.
Good.
That is your Canada Land. I can be emailed about today's show at jesse@canadaland.com. I'm also on Canada Land's Discord channel, where I'm hanging out with my colleagues and hundreds of Canada Land supporters, and we're having some really good conversations there. You're very welcome to come join us. Bruce Thorson is our senior producer. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Today's episode was fact-checked by Julian Abraham. Max Collins is our director of audio. I'm Canada Land's editor and publisher. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Canada Land, funded by you.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we are talking about the news. We'll talk about the bumbling mayor of Springfield, Manitoba, and why that mayor has banned citizens from recording public meetings. We'll talk about changes to Canada Pension Plan, which nobody seems to have noticed except for Andrew Coyne. But mostly we'll talk about the Irish rap group Kneecap. We'll talk about Canada's new hate crime law, and we'll talk about Strombo. He's back with a new look, viral misinformation. Didn't see that coming.
Feelings don't necessarily make for good policy. Your feelings, while invited to the show, shouldn't necessarily have a backstage pass.
Wait for that. Welcome back to the show, journalist, Substacker, and newsfluencer. You might have seen Isaac on Instagram or TikTok talking about the news. Welcome back, Isaac Peltz.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
An Irish rap group named Kneecap
has been banned from entering Canada.
Kneecap was supposed to play multiple sold-out shows in Toronto and Vancouver next month.
Deemed ineligible over what the federal government says is their open endorsement of terrorist organizations.
That's according to a post from Toronto MP Vince Gasparo.
I am announcing that effective immediately, the members of Kneecap have been deemed ineligible to enter Canada.
Well, Kneecap obviously not happy, as they are now threatening and have started legal action against the Toronto MP.
One member of the band is currently facing terrorism-related charges in the United Kingdom.
The terrorism case against the Kneecap rapper Liam O'Gohany has been thrown out following a technical error.
It seems like the Canadian ban might not hold.
For now, Canadian fans will have to catch them in Europe, where publicity from this case has inadvertently boosted ticket sales.
You following this one?
Oh, yeah. It became way funnier to me earlier this week when it turns out no one has any idea what's going on at all.
First of all, are you a hip-hop fan?
I am a hip-hop fan, yes. Hard not to be in 2025. I'm a big hip-hop fan, but I have never listened to Kneecap. Didn't know they existed until this controversy.
What happened on Monday?
It turns out they might not have been banned. It's a confusing scenario, and I don't think we have any answers yet as to whether it had been banned. Maybe on publication we'll have some answers, but for the moment, it's a little confusing.
All right, so Vince Gasparo, who's the MP in the riding where the Liberals asked me to run, a lot of Jewish voters in this riding. Vince Gasparo's not Jewish, but he's got to think about his constituents. I thought that might have something to do with it, the timing of this. So Vince Gasparo goes online, and there's a video of him, and he's speaking for the government, and we're banning Kneecap.
Advocating for political violence, glorifying terrorist organizations, and displaying hate symbols that directly target the Jewish community are not protected forms of expression and will not be tolerated by our government. That is why, as Parliamentary Secretary for Combating Crime, I am announcing that effective immediately, the members of Kneecap have been deemed ineligible to enter Canada.
And then it gets dug into, and there's like all this like haziness. Sources of the PMO are saying like, well, he didn't tell us about that. And then no one else was able to confirm that. He's accused of lying. I'm always hesitant, you know, never attribute to lying what could maybe be explained by some rookie MP not knowing what's going on. He's saying, I got nothing more to say about this.
In terms of the actual commentary, I have nothing further to add. And any further comments, immigration officials will answer.
It is unclear as to what the status is of Kneecap, whether they're actually banned from Canada or not. So that's part of why this has become a little bit of a farce.
Yep. A farce is an accurate way to describe this situation.
Now, the case for banning Kneecap, well, I guess it depends on who you ask. If you get your news from Strombo, George Strombolopoulos has been active on social media, and here's what he had to say about why Kneecap was banned or why Gasparo might want to ban Kneecap.
Canada has banned the musicians in the crew Kneecap. Settle down. Let me talk about this. Because of their direct appeals to stop what's happening in Gaza, a position that millions of Canadians share. And the member of the government who made this decision made some pretty serious statements and allegations about the band that they have refuted from the very beginning. And I can confirm this because they have refuted them to me directly.
Okay. So according to Strombo, the reason why Kneecap was banned was because of their position on Gaza. That's not true. We just had the Toronto International Film Festival. There were tons of celebrities in here who have taken similar positions on Gaza. Nobody was banning them from the country. It's one thing to disagree with the reasons for why Jewish community groups wanted to ban Kneecap and why the government, some members of the government anyhow, seem to agree with that. But to just pretend that those aren't the reasons seems strange to me. The reason why people wanted to ban Kneecap is because at a concert, here's how I'll put it. This is from an article in the Taiyi, because even the way that those who acknowledge this put it is really weird. Footage emerged of a 2024 show in the UK where band member Mo Chara appears to chant, "Up Hamas, up Hezbollah," and wave a Hezbollah flag. And you'll read this again and again, that they are alleged to have said, "Up Hamas, up Hezbollah." They are alleged to have said this. Where could people have gotten the idea? Where do these allegations come from? There's a video. Let's hear the video. Up Hamas, up Hezbollah. He is draped around the shoulders in a Hezbollah flag. Now, just giving you the facts here, they later said they don't support Hamas and Hezbollah, and the flag was just thrown on stage, and that this clip was taken out of context. I don't know what the full context is. Like, maybe he said, "Everything I'm about to say, I don't agree with. Up Hamas, up Hezbollah." And then it was edited in a very misleading way. But I think that they said, "Up Hamas, up Hezbollah." And I think that he was draped in a Hezbollah flag that didn't just land on him. And if you watch the video, it's quite clear that they said these things, just as they also said, "The only good Tory is a dead Tory. Kill your local MP." Those statements, they actually acknowledged and apologized to the families of murdered MPs after that came to light. So maybe it's okay that they said, "Up Hamas and up Hezbollah." Maybe Hamas and Hezbollah, somebody's going to make a case for why they're great. But let's at least, like, stop talking over Jews and erasing Jews who are very clear about why they want this group banned, because they consider Hamas and Hezbollah to be hate groups. They are registered terrorist entities that have long histories of virulently anti-Semitic statements. And to have NECAP come to Canada and lead chants, which happen at NECAP concerts, of Intifada Revolution, which I accept has different meanings to different people, is something that, like, that is the argument that Jewish people are making and disagree with it. But to just pretend that's not the argument, as Strombo for some reason did, feels like just really dishonest to me, super dishonest. Isaac, all of that being said, I don't want to ban rappers. I don't want to ban anybody. I don't like it. I don't like it. And I think we got to look at the context of this as well, which is in context with this new proposed hate speech law from Carney. You following that?
Yep. Oh, yeah. I think with the NECAP ban, it's interesting. I find it, the whole reporting around it has been confusing. The MP talking about it is confusing. NECAP shouldn't have been banned. Full stop. There's a lot of people in this country who feel that they feel sympathy, like a lot of sympathies for groups like Hamas. Hamas, for example, a lot of people, it depends on how you frame it. You can say rebel group trying to free Palestine versus you can say a terrorist, right? So there's a lot of people with sympathies, but this isn't really the question at the center of this. The question at the center of this is, are people going to have their free speech suppressed? And what is going to happen with Bill C-9? Right. And what is going to happen if we're going to start saying, well, you said this in support of someone we hate? Now, there is argument to ban hate symbols. Right. I don't think Nazi symbols should be allowed to be flown. In Germany, they have banned anything with Nazi symbols for good reason.
You're in favor of banning hate symbols, but the ones that you think are hate symbols and not the ones that you don't think are hate symbols.
See, this is a complex topic, right?
Yeah.
And we don't have a capacity as a society to have complex discussions, because I wouldn't consider Hamas a hate group. I would consider them an insurgency against an apartheid government. But then at the same time, it's like, well, in that case, should I be saying then we should ban Nazi symbols? And I'm like, well, because I'm not a free speech absolutist. I'm not. I just don't agree that we need to have absolute free speech at the cost of everything.
Isaac, you know from your last appearance on this show that we duly note stories to make sure that people don't miss important news stories. What do you have to point out to people today?
The CPP is going through big changes, the Canada Pension Plans. It is mostly invested outside of Canada first. It is good to note that. And it is making much less in returns than a good investor who is just investing a normal amount of money or managing somebody else's money. And it seems that with waves of people retiring, Andrew Coyne, a very well-known journalist, is one of the few who is covering this subject. The Washington Post, I believe, has also done some stuff on it, but mostly it's Coyne talking about this. It is not enough in the news. Very few people are talking about it, and people do not realize that there is a fundamental restructuring going on to the Canadian pension plan. It may have a serious problem in the future and may not have the financial structures to support the amount of people who will be on it soon. And we should be watching this all over the country as the media.
That is definitely worth duly noting and is terrifying. Duly noted. I have one. It's a little one, but the little things can matter. This is from one of the last city newspapers, independent city newspapers in Canada, the Winnipeg Free Press. Residents fight Springfield's ban on recording council meetings. News from Springfield. What is Springfield? Springfield is a rural municipality in Manitoba. I think about 16,000 people live there. And four of them say that their municipal government should not be banning them from recording city council meetings or town council meetings. What? Yeah, there are four people who have been recording their local legislature on their phones, and they have been banned from doing so. And they have enlisted the help of constitutional lawyers to help them in their legal battle against the rural municipality. I think we have to, as long as we still have a press in this country, the relationship between the disappearance of the free press and the ascendance of governments who don't want you to record them, there's a direct relationship, I would say. Correlation, causation, I don't know. But the fewer journalists there are, the more the powers that be will say, stop taping me, stop recording me. And fundamental principles about how democracy is supposed to be run in public. And I think we got to get over this thing. There's a lot of hesitancy within the dying legacy media towards figures like Karim Assad and others who are like basically picking up the slack and doing a lot of the on-the-ground reporting, whether it's at protests or in legislatures. More and more of this work is being done by people who look weird. They look weird. Why are they there? We're there because we're paid to be there. Why are these other people there? What's their agenda? Some of them do have an agenda. Some of them are unpleasant. Some, I don't know. But I feel like those of us who are concerned with press freedoms need to embrace the citizen journalists and understand that it's not about protecting a professional class, journalism as a professional class. It's about protecting journalism as a human right. It's the rights that we're protecting, not our industry. So with that being said, I'm speaking up for these four residents of Springfield.
Duly noted.
That is our show for today. Thank you for joining me. You can email me about it. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com, and I am active on the Canada Land Discord channel, chatting with our supporters and my colleagues here all the time. Come hang out with us there. It's a fantastic online community with really good discussions. Isaac, where can people find you?
I highly recommend that everyone go to isaacpeltz.ca and sign up for my newsletter. It's $5. It's almost nothing. Listen, that's less than a coffee in 2025. And I am insane. So, like, I do crazy shit, okay, man? Like, I go to the front of picket line. I'm, like, one of the few who's everywhere. I'm out there getting tear gassed and pepper sprayed by the police because I want footage of protests. And give me $5 so I can buy saline solution, because that burns. Go to isaacpeltz.ca.
Game, respect, game. That was a strong pitch. Go. This episode is produced by James Nicholson. Our associate producer is Lucy Lemonnier, who also did the fact check. Mixing and mastering is by Caleb Thompson. Our director of audio is Max Collins. I am Canada Land's editor and publisher. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. You can listen ad-free on Amazon Music, which is included with Prime.
Down the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic. Every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record.
Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gales!
With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage.
Looking for Nico Cuomo! Cuomo! My goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown!
Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action.
Step into a world where stories meet sound. My name is Simmer Kaur, host of Melodies of Myth, a show that blends Indian classical and Western music with short tales of culture, history, and identity. Join me every Friday at 3 p.m. only on CFRC. And if you enjoy the music, you can find more by searching Simmer Kaur on Spotify. Tune in, unwind, and let the melodies carry you. Once again, it's Melodies of Myth, 3 p.m. every Fridays.
Looking for a ride? Download the Modern City Taxi app to your mobile device and get to your destination quickly and safely while supporting a proudly Canadian local business, keeping your money in the community. Download the app now and get extra benefits like free advance booking, the ability to add your credit card and pay on the go, enjoying the freedom from price surging during high demand times. You can also call for a cab at 613-546-2222 any time of day or night for comfortable and speedy transportation. Serving Kingston since 1939, Modern Taxi proudly supports local radio and the Queens community. It is your number one service for fast local transportation. Learn more at moderncitytaxi.ca.
As the cooler weather sets in the Kingston area, CFRC and KPP concerts are turning up the heat with a stacked fall lineup. On October 10th, check out Shania Twink, followed by the Arrogant Worms on October 11th at Broom Factory. Sloan hits the Ale House on October 18th, and folks can catch the Grapes of Wrath on October 22nd, Crywank on November 1st, and Georgia Harmer on November 8th at the Broom. Billy Faffel, Guy Davis, and Rhea May are also playing at the Broom on November 12th, 15th, and 16th, respectively. For a complete list of shows and ticket information, visit kppconcerts.com. Visit the Screening Room, Kingston's only independent movie theater located downtown at 120 Princess Street. They specialize in playing art house, international classic, and cult cinema, along with Hollywood's best new releases. People also always say they have the best popcorn in town. Visit Screening Room at screeningroom.com for upcoming show dates and ticket information. Shoelace, first time.